But understand that question. I want to very briefly review where the three of us have gone, sometimes severally and sometimes collectively, supplemented by reading sessions up at July 14th. But we began by asking people to talk about, and some of you were here, the last step. How many of you were here the first day that people talked about the work they did? It's a small percentage now. But people talked about how they felt about their work. And from this, we, primarily Tim and Ed, drew some generalizations. And the next day, talked about the threats that people perceived as drawn from the comments. Threats to well-being, enjoyment, status, income, any kind of threat. And focused on the criticism that people perceived. I think there was a good deal more than this than what people were saying, what they were talking about. But I also think there was a useful focus on the criticism that we perceived ourselves as being under. Sometimes it was voiced by the people around us. Sometimes it was just implicit in the look they gave us. Sometimes it was just the voice of our own conscience, which may have been tuned in appropriately, maybe inappropriately, to what was going on. And then Ed pushed hard on the question of, when you hear criticism, what is the source of that criticism? And you go back the other, Ed was trying to get people to say that God was the ultimate critic. I find that very useful and essentially correct notion, because any kind of criticism that I find myself forced to take seriously, I have to regard as from the ultimate good. Right? If someone criticizes me and I'm convinced he's wrong, he's totally wrong, he's out of step with things. I gave the example of a member of the mafia criticizes me for not maintaining my ties to the mafia. You know, that's not a valid criticism. But I'd say the point is I don't take it seriously in my own conscience. It doesn't really bother me. It may scare me for a different reason, but you know. But it's not, if some very weak person, little five-year-old child who can't physically harm me at all or deprive me of any income, says, why are you so mean? There's a way in which that may enter into, it will enter into me, and I'll say, why did he say that? And I will begin the process of self-justification. Well, yesterday, Ed got us thinking some more about this process of self-justification. And the ways in which we do it, and I think he made clear to me at least how pervasive is the human urge to justify oneself. And then Ed suggested that that was a destructive way of becoming justified. Suggested that we could find in the lessons for each week some resources for becoming justified in quite a different way. Some resources that might enable us not to attack God or set ourselves up against his ordering of the universe and see him as the enemy. Resources that would enable us to see God as on our side, someone who has visibly, tangibly shown that whatever the criticisms he levels against us, he is ultimately on our side. Well, one of the things that I had wanted to do, and Ed's a strong person despite his size, and I wanted to spend a little more time on work again. I thought that yesterday we got somewhat far from the subject of work, and that really Ed was talking about the whole general phenomenon of criticism and self-justification. Well, Tim and I haven't really rehearsed. We didn't know until early this morning that we were even going to have another session. And then Ed was committed to a hike, and he better go because this is the first day of his 21st year of marriage, and so he better go with his family. But I don't know what it means that he's getting rained on in the process. I want to say a few things. I think I'll be finished in 10 minutes. If I'm not, somebody whistle, and then I'll know I better quit quickly. I may be finished faster than that. I want to present an analysis of work that I suppose it has to be informed in some way by my theological thinking, because everything is. But it didn't consciously grow out of that. It really grew out of an attempt, a rather intense effort during the past year, to understand why people made such a botch of work. And I mean such a human botch of work. Why people who worked together were often behaved so destructively toward one another. Why it was there, my question was, is there something in the nature of work or in the nature of the social systems by which we control work that makes it almost inevitable that people will mutually undermine one another when they, it seems, could so easily mutually support one another? And it has brought me out, I think you'll see, to some conclusions that run strikingly parallel, at least I see them strikingly parallel, to what Ed was saying, and what Tim was saying, with largely through questioning the first couple of days. And what I was hoping we would do yesterday is that I could lay this out, and Ed, with his marvelously incisive mind and his tremendous, almost unparalleled instinct for bringing the theoretical and the practical together. You heard him at Vespers on Tuesday. You know, we were talking about new noise of the movie. Ed is a marvelous blend of the sacred and the profane. But I wanted to see what he would do with this. All right. Now, it's going to start out kind of general, and I hope it'll become more specific. The division of labor, meaning specialization, meaning the fact that some people are stockbrokers and some people are street sweepers, some are teachers. In fact, we carry specialization beyond that. Some are teachers of geology. Some are teachers of geology in graduate courses only. Some, specialization has been carried to an incredible extent in our society. I wonder if there are any two people who do the same thing. I sometimes wonder about that. Now, but this phenomenon, division of labor, specialization, has been primarily responsible, economists think so anyway, and I think it can be demonstrated, has been primarily responsible for pushing back a considerable distance the physical threats that impinge on us. Now, what I'm saying is division of labor has made us rich. I'm talking now, of course, about the Western world, the industrialized world. That has been the primary reason why, if people starve to death in our society, it's as if because there's been a bad follow-up somewhere. You know, we do not live close to the margin of physical subsistence. We don't live anywhere near it. And the reason for this is division of labor. Now, I think that's very important. In the story of Adam and Eve, Adam, the ground was cursed because of him, or for his sake, it says, for his good or for his ill. Anyway, the ground was cursed, and it would bring forth thorns and thistles, and he would have to laboriously get them out by the sweat of his brow. That's a physical constraint. I mean, Adam didn't have time to go off to Holden Village, because when he came back, the thorns and the thistles would have crowded out the carrots, and he and Eve would have starved the next winter. But nowadays, we've got herbicides and pesticides, but those things, you see, we tend to say, well, it's our technology. But that technology came about because we've got people specializing in herbicide research and herbicide manufacture. If we all had to produce these things for ourselves, everybody do everything, everybody had to be a jack of all trades, we would go back to a kind of very low subsistence living that people knew, that most people know throughout most of history. However, now comes the kicker. While the division of labor has pushed farther from us physical constraints, division of labor requires coordination. If everybody's going to do some different little thing, if the whole system has to be put together, otherwise, it'd be just grand, utter chaos. How is it put together? Come that moment. I think there are basically two ways in which a society coordinates the division of labor. But the point of it all is that the process of coordination introduces or intensifies social threats, social constraints. There's been a trade-off. I think we have to learn to see that. That we have pushed physical constraint further away, but we have intensified social threat. So that the threats that most of us live under in connection with work, the thorns and thistles that are produced in our work, are not the thorns and thistles of nature, physical nature. They are the thorns and thistles of social relationships. I said there are two systems of social coordination. One I call the hierarchical, and the other is the market. Now, these are easy enough to understand. A hierarchical organization simply means there's a boss, and he tells the people under him what to do, and he's responsible for seeing to it that they do so. Because they don't act on their own. Now, it's impossible to control any person's behavior completely, but if the task is relatively simple, doesn't require a whole lot of judgment, it is possible for one person to serve as supervisor for 10 others and coordinate their activity in this hierarchical way. And suppose you've got 10 people who have to move all of the furniture of Koinonia over to the village center. Now that task will require some coordination. Maybe it requires so little that you wouldn't need a coordinator, but you would at least need a supervisor to tell them to do it, and tell them by what time it had to be done, and answer the question. Somebody says, does the fireplace here go? And you could move that too. All right. If the task gets too complicated, or there are too many people under, you set up layers of coordination. And finally, example is the typical business firm, large business firm. You've got the president at the top, and underneath him are vice presidents, and then you go on down, finally get down to the production worker. That's an example of hierarchical coordination. But there's another system of coordination that we use. It's market coordination. Here, people are not doing what fits in with other people because somebody told them to, but because they're looking around and seeing what other people are offering and what other people are willing to buy and trying to act themselves in such a fashion as to maximize their own advantage. Now, of course, this is the president up at the top of the firm, or whoever's in charge of this hierarchical firm I was talking about. He really is constrained largely by the market. His activity is coordinated by the market. He buys and sells. He has to look at the price of labor and the price of other raw materials and look at the price he can get for his product. And so he's engaged constantly in voluntary exchange and in negotiations with people to make voluntary exchange. Now, our whole economic system, I think, can usefully be thought of as coordinated by both of these mechanisms. Within firms, what you've got is a vast milk bucket coordinated by market, but inside it there are coagulated lumps of butter swimming in it, which are bits of hierarchical coordination. Is that clear? If it isn't, it'll maybe become clearer. As I point out, some of the different social constraints that operate in these two systems. Maybe for purposes of simplicity, you can say hierarchical coordination. Here's a guy who's working in an office. Okay, and he's got colleagues, and he's got supervisors. And he's got an office manager or a foreman, and above him there are people. Right, that's the model of hierarchical coordination. Market coordination, think of the guy who runs the grocery store. He owns it himself. He's not working for anybody else. He's got to worry about, am I properly located? Should I, Mrs. Schlops said that she wanted a Russian, wishbone Russian dressing. She's the only person who wants it. Should I order it? If I do order it, it's going to be costly. And I can't carry all these brands. But then again, she might take her business somewhere else. And these are the life of somebody who works for himself, the life of the so-called self-employed person, is not an easy one. It might be useful if we stop using the term self-employed, because very few people are self-employed. Most people are employed by consumers. You think of a taxi driver, for example. What do you do when you want a taxi? You hire a taxi driver. You employ him. And, his life is a very dangerous one, because you go somewhere in a taxi, and you don't even hire him for the time that you go and come back. When you get in there, you fire him. And he has to go looking for somebody else to work for. And then when you want to come back, you hire another taxi driver. See how very uncertain it is, right? So in the case of market coordination law, the threats, the constraints, come from many unknown other people. In the case of hierarchical coordination, the threats, the constraints, come from generally a few pretty clearly defined others. You can call them by name. All right, in the case of hierarchical coordination, you get greater certainty of a sort. You know, life is more certain. Your life is more predictable. Now you get a certain regular salary, usually under hierarchical coordination. Your task is always going to be there. You don't come in the morning worrying that there won't be any work to do. In fact, you kind of hope there won't be any work to do because you get paid anyway. The guy who has to worry about that is the guy up at the top who's engaged in hierarchical coordination. But along with this greater certainty comes greater possibility of arbitrary decisions. You know, when you are subject to the supervision or control of just a few other people, and one of them turns out to be a fink, or to have a headache, or to have gotten bitten by a dog that morning, or he doesn't like you, you are subject to very arbitrary decisions. You know, if some people decide, if I'm running a grocery store, and some people decide they don't like the color of my politics, that isn't much of a threat. But when you're subject to the control of just a few people, the decisions that affect your life can be extremely arbitrary. I know this very vividly. I happened to be the chairman of my department. He happened to be a very weird man. And that fact that he is the chairman of my department has made my life extremely unpredictable. He does some of the weirdest things over here. All right. When you're working in a situation where your activity is coordinated with the activity of others through the market, you have a wider scope for choice. You have more options. But the consequences of your choices are far less predictable. Hierarchical coordination, I think this is very important, leads to semi-permanent social groupings. Yeah, sure, people turn over, but it's the same people down there that you're dealing with all the time. You go the guys at work. So, you know, you may have a party, or a Christmas party, all the guys at work, the people at work. But how many people who run grocery stores have a Christmas party for all the customers at work? What they do, it's really a PR job. And it's not a real party. You don't know them. You probably don't even know them by name. So the semi-permanent social groupings, in the case of hierarchical coordination, should be contrasted with the highly mobile, highly fluid social groupings that characterize market coordination. In the market system, the threat comes, as I said, from unknown others who do not treat us as persons and hence do not care for us. Now, I use that word care for us in two senses. And when you say, John really cares for Margaret, in a way you mean kind of loves, likes, and goes for somebody special. There's another sense. I am caring for my sick uncle. That means trying to anticipate his needs. Now, these two things go together, but I don't know which I mean when I say care for us. I think I mean both, although one of them seems terribly sentimental thing to expect of people at work. But I do know that people at work typically do not care. I mean, the people who come into the grocery store typically do not care for the proprietor in either sense. That doesn't mean they dislike him. They just don't care for him. He's an it. Harvey Cox, in his book, The Secular City, suggested that we had misled ourselves by supposing that the ideal human relationship in all situations was I-thou, you know, that personal encounter where you empathize and stand in the shoes of the other person. You know, instead of Martin Buber's terminology, instead of the I-it relationship where I treat you as a thing to be manipulated. Well, that's a very valuable distinction that Buber came up with, but Cox suggested there's something in between, a kind of an I-you, he says, where it's the friendly but impersonal relationship that I have with the milkman, with the postal delivery clerk, and you know, with all the people whom we encounter in the market. It's friendly. I don't snap at the girl at the checkout counter. But on the other hand, you know, I don't ask myself, I wonder how she's getting along at home. Moreover, if I find out that she's has, if say I look at her little badge and I see that her name has changed, I say, hey, Irene, what'd you do? Your name's changed. She says, oh, I got divorced. I may say, oh. Then I won't even know whether to say I'm sorry or congratulations. See, that's what I mean by it. I mean, I could banter with her every time I come in, and still I don't know her well enough to care for her. I can't care for her. Maybe at that moment what she needs is somebody to tell her, I'm terribly sorry, because she feels that nobody really cares about her. Her life has been shattered. No one really cares. But there she is at work, 8 hours a day, suffering intensely, and most of the people with whom she comes in contact can't possibly care for her. In other words, someone, and I just think this is terribly important, someone whose work is coordinated through the market primarily is working for strangers. I think it's hard to work all day for strangers. Now let's shift to the hierarchical, because that's where most of us really make our living, in hierarchical situations. The hierarchical threat comes from others who do know us as persons pretty well, somewhat anyway, but don't trust us, and hence do not care for us. I've gone over 10 minutes. I'm going to finish quickly. But now I think this is the thing that has bothered me the most, and also has directed my further thinking the most. But I don't think that people who work with one another in offices, shops, factories, trust one another. There are very, very rare exceptions. And the question is, why don't they trust us? And the basic answer, and I'm going to give very basic answers, which you're quite free to disagree with, they fear that we may behave in ways that threaten them. Now, I'm thinking about the people who work under us, possibly, the people who are our colleagues, and the people who are our supervisors. I have all three of these in mind when I talk about those who work with us. They fear that we may behave in ways that threaten them. You know, the supervisor is afraid that we may goof off and sabotage the process, and he's going to catch it from upstairs. The fellow worker may be afraid that we're going to bust the rate or show him up or not carry our end of the load, and he will catch the flack. Of course, the person below us, obviously, is afraid of the way in which we behave, because we have substantial power over his life. And because they don't trust us, and say they don't trust us because they don't really know us, they don't really know what kind of people we are. But because they don't trust us and cannot follow us completely, supervise us, I mean, even a fellow worker can't keep an eye on us to make sure that we're not doing something that's going to threaten them. Because they can't do that, what they do is establish what I call success indicators by which they evaluate us. A success indicator, for example, your supervisor wants you to do the work, but now he establishes a success indicator. Be at work at 8:30, prompt. Now, there are many circumstances in which your being at work at 8:30 prompt would contribute nothing to your successful working, but he can't trust you. If he lets you come in when you please, he doesn't know what you're going to do. And so he says, all right, now look, be here at 8:30. So what do you do? Instead of doing a good job, you come in at 8:30. I was using an example yesterday talking to John about the possibility of someone took work home to type, say a secretary, typing it on a typewriter that's slightly different, almost finished, and he says, my gosh, it's 8:05. If I don't leave now, I'm going to be late for work, and am I going to catch it? And so she takes all the work that she's typed and throws it out, goes to the office and types it all over again, consuming more time and doing a worse job for her supervisor, because her concern is not to do a good job, but to satisfy the success indicator, which was erected to get her to do a good job in a context where she couldn't be trusted. What we have to do with everybody around us erecting success indicators, sometimes formal, sometimes informal, very difficult to discern, though we usually learn what they are. You know, like one of the success indicators in my department was attendance at faculty parties, departmental parties. That was a success. If you didn't come, there was something wrong with you. What were you doing? what's he plotting? Certain kinds of votes, utterly meaningless votes, where we were required to sacrifice our consciences in order to demonstrate that we were willing to follow the party line. I could multiply examples, I will not. But we have to struggle to satisfy the success indicators or seem to satisfy them. That's different from doing a good job, and now here comes the double bind. Hence, we are continually involved in deception because I know that I'm really satisfying the success indicator or seeming to satisfy the success indicator. And I know that's wrong. That's not what I really should. I should be doing a good job. And instead, I'm trying to look good. I'm trying to get a star on the chart instead of brushing my teeth. I'm trying to get the little kids wet the toothbrush and throw it back in the closet. And consequently, I in fact behave in an untrustworthy fashion. I'm operating in a system that requires me to behave in an untrustworthy fashion to succeed. And so I do so. And that indeed makes me untrustworthy and justifies the fact that the people around me don't trust me. The problem doesn't, however, necessarily originate with others, because I perceive the inherent threat in other people's evaluations. The chairman, will he recommend me for a raise? The dean, will he give me a raise if the chairman recommends it? Or if the chairman doesn't recommend it, will he give me a raise anyway? My colleagues, when the chairman comes around and talks to them and says, how's Hayne been doing? What do you think of his work? Has he added anything? The graduate students, the students who will fill out formal evaluation, you know, it goes on and on. The member of the board of trustees who was sitting there listening when I was giving a talk to a group of businessmen. It's a large group. But because I perceive the inherent threat in their evaluations, I struggle to devise my own list of success indicators and, you know, some things that I can show good at. And I try to subtly push them up. Like I will say, oh, I don't think publication in scholarly journals is all that important. Quality teaching, is it? Because I'm a better teacher than I am a publisher. So I push my own success indicators. And then I turn out to be an untrustworthy person then. I erect inaccurate success indicators and strive to seem to fulfill them, which further justifies the lack of trust that other people have in me. In my efforts to experiment in my own work environment, I have time after time come back to the realization that there's no place to begin. That nothing new is possible until we can trust one another. But we can't trust one another as long as we behave toward one another in threatening ways, or are perceived as behaving in threatening ways, or potentially behaving in threatening ways. And we will do that because we don't fully know one another, and hence can't fully trust one another. And around we go. Oh, where do you break into this? If it is a concern to you. Maybe my whole concern is terribly utopian, but I assure you that I am going to try in the next few years to create for myself and in collaboration with other people some additional work environments in which people do not undermine but support one another. Well, yeah.
Can I have 5 minutes before?
Sure.
Okay, before we open it up for discussion.
I see.
As you were talking, a lot of things were coming to mind. And they came to mind so fast that I don't have too many conclusions, but maybe this could provide useful material in the discussion even later. There's two biblical models for what I see to be the hierarchical and the market system. And many parallels occurred as you were just tracking out the benefits and also the hazards of the hierarchical system and also the market system. For the hierarchical system, I don't know how many people have Bibles, but in Genesis 4, now we were on Genesis 3 yesterday, which means one more chapter seems to be following the discussion closely. In Genesis 4, I'll just read to you a few verses, the story of Cain and Abel, and notice these three things that Paul just tracked out. One, the system of hierarchy, order between not only Cain and Abel, but between God, Cain, and Abel. Now there's a boss, and there's an order of hierarchy, and the struggle is establishing, you know, who's tops on the totem pole. Number two, watch for the emphasis on the success indicators in Cain and Abel, how Cain is so sensitive to what is successful and what is not. And in fact, God is too. He sets up the system. Number three, watch for how Cain sets up his own success indicator, that is what he does to Abel, and how he engages in the system of unfaith, which is the definition of sin, not trusting the boss. He establishes his own success system, and how he deceives, and then finally how this whole system of deception really turns into the judgment of the boss on Cain. And so notice, everything that you said is parallel in these three verses. Won't take too long. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, specialization, and Cain was a tiller of the ground, specialization, hierarchy. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, success indicator. How is the offering going to be regarded? And Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portion. I produced this on the job and he produces that on the job. What's the status of our production? And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry and why has your countenance fallen?" Says the Lord, "If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door, it's desirous for you, but you must master it." Hierarchical pressure. And then Cain said to Abel, his brother, now, the success indicators have been set up, and now Cain, not being able to accept those and being able to handle those, in the system of trust, begins to engage in the system of deception, his own success indicators. Says to Abel, his brother, "Let us go out into the field." That's the setup. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord, unfaith, distrust, own success indicators. He's trying to set up his own system. And now the boss comes back, who is really the critic in this whole system of deception, the real boss. And he says to Cain, "Where is Abel your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Front. And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to you from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Now the judgment when you till the ground shall no longer be of your strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." And Cain, not being able to bear this, said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me this day away from the ground, and from the face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Fugitives in jobs. Wanderers in jobs. "And whoever finds me will slay me." Tremendous anxiety in this kind of system. Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, a sentence he came upon him to kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod and Eden. I think, though, what you were saying really has a lot of bearing in this particular story. How, even in a small community, the system of hierarchical success indicators is so present, and how this trust can take over people so greatly, even between brothers, and how the final person that we have to worry about is the critic, and how the critic really is the judge of our deception and our suffering. What's the answer to that then? What other word does the judge have for us in our work? A little bit less long, real quickly, the other system, the market system, the system where there is really a sort of self-employment, less security, but still deception, mistrust, a lot of anxiety. And funny, even in this system, as with the previous one, who is the final judge of this anxiety in the market system? answer the judge himself. If you want to look at where this model is found, it's found in James 4, beginning at verse 13 through chapter 5. Actually, the book of James was written to farmers. So if anybody is in a farm community, a preacher to farmers, or if you want to just preach to George, you know, which is the name of Latin for farmers, preach on James, because it deals with a market system in a community of farmers. Different people who are in different trades and different jobs. And the problem is that there's been a famine in the land, and people are ripping off each other. You know, the laborers aren't getting paid the proper wages. Farmers are competing against each other. There's just a lot of anxiety because of the weather system, the dry land, and he's going to rip off who next. And people are grumbling. And so James begins to track out what all this grumbling means in a market system. You know, that the final thing that you have to worry about is not, you know, ripping off each other, but the judge who is judging your impatience, your distrust of him. And so you're going to take out the distrust of the judge and your Lord on each other. You know, anxiety, what's next, how can I rip off my brother, and so on. And so James begins to tell about how we in this market system, those farmers, those Georgians, you know, can begin to sort of recoup patience, trust. And he gives biblical examples of Job and the prophets, and just gives a good word. Well, more to be said, I don't want to take up too much time. But those are two models, I think, that kind of parallel what he said. And I think they tell us a lot about trust and mistrust, deception and faith.
Right now, can I suppose, I think that's fabulous. I'm glad to see that the Bible in general supports my way of looking at things. it's interesting. I know that when you're just talking about seeing the story, and it struck me how appropriate it is. Be careful, though, about preaching from James. The farmer James is had kind of some prejudices there.
About faith and work?
Well, not to say, yes, an economic prejudice too, kind of hostile to wealth. So many of your farmers are wealthy. I'd like to ask this question, or you don't have to speak to this question, but it's the question now that I'm really asking. So if this is, suppose this is a human condition. This is the human condition. It is the human condition of man against God. Man out of relationship with God, that this mistrust and anxiety is part of the workplace. You can't get rid of it. What do you do? You can get rid of, I suppose, you can get rid of your own distrust. But is that productive at work? Or are we not required at work to be distrustful in order to do a good job? I mean, suppose the supervisor says, I am no longer going to distrust my workers because I no longer have any fear. I know that God is the ultimate critic, and despite my bossing up, he forgives, he restores, he makes me new every morning. So I'm no longer even going to check the time clock. To lose his job. So we've got the problem of, even if one of us could live in the knowledge that we are justified by grace, and so we don't have to feel threats from other people, that when we receive criticism or threat, we can listen to it, accept it, change if that seems appropriate, and be free in the face of threat. What would happen at the workplace? I am not persuaded that the workplace would substantially improve. Our anxiety level might go down. On the other hand, we might find ourselves subjected to such, we might find ourselves pushed around in a physical sense. Supervisors can be discharged. Is there any, I said one question, it's just a bit complicated, but is there any reason why we Christians might want to work exclusively with Christians? So as to create the possibility of a workplace that is grounded in trust.
Oh,
no, it is impossible. Well, Tim, why don't you be chairman? You need to know how to get short answers to questions.
Have they ever done an analysis, a study of the criminal business? A man who relegated, basically his comment, his whole philosophy was that all that he had, his great wealth, definitely was a gift from God. The more he received, the more he gave in his business and his profit. And I was wondering, I've also wondered within, internally within that business, if there was a, quote, a, in a sense, a Christian philosophy or attitude which may have prevailed. Also, I remember reading some time ago, I can't place the little community where it was, but I think where it makes a big difference, and I'd be interested to see how the thing works out, was if one business had gone almost way down to the bottom, like ready to close down. And so then they got together, and each person in that place, in a sense, became an equal shareholder or stockholder of it, the employee. So what I would do for you, or my work, would benefit you, your work in turn would benefit me. And I've often wanted to speak to you within that context, how that business has done, or if they have moved, you know, started out so good, and then maybe now have moved to a point, well, I'm going to have a little more control than this new one.
There's been a lot of work. For your first question, I can answer the second question. There's been a lot of studies and a lot of historical experience with profit sharing producers. I call them producers cooperatives, is a short answer. And everybody kind of works for everybody else and they share out. And they have been dismal failures. They have failed to create community. They have broken up very quickly. They have foundered, except for those that were grounded in a religious commitment. The successful ones have been the ones grounded in a religious commitment.
How about the ESOP program? Are you acquainted with that law so far?
No.
It's a new system where you can take a corporation and tax-free give stock at a corporation to the employees in lieu of paying or in addition to paying they are for ownership. So that it becomes an ownership thing. Managed is still under, it's an unbroken process, but there's a new program that the government has put out where you can do this in a company. And I think that it's financially set up so that it makes economic sense. In fact, one of my good friends, who is a president of a corporation, that is very just thinking of going into this, and I know he's a very hard-nosed businessman.
Well, the profit sharing has been around for a long time, and profit sharing.
This is ownership. These people actually are.
Well, okay, part owners, but okay, part, but you said management still runs the shop,
right.
And it turns out that that's the crux of the problem. There have been some companies with long experience. There's one in Minnesota, the meat packer in. They've got one of the longest process. But some things I've read, Sears, I think, yeah. And it doesn't really, I think it contributes something, but it doesn't really get at the core of the problem. And it's for a very simple reason, you know, when you and I each have a couple shares of stock in Sears Roebuck, and we're both working for Sears Roebuck, we know that. How much will it hurt me if you goof off? Mm-hmm. And how much will it help me if I work like a dog? You know, once again, so the real place where we meet is, we're not capable, for the most part, of making any decisions that will seriously affect our ownership interest, so that our employee interest tends to dominate our ownership interest. You understand? I may be getting my ownership, it doesn't amount to enough financially or in any other way, to dominate my, I'm an employee for 8 hours a day, and I'm a shareholder only quarterly, and my wages are much bigger than my dividends. I don't think that profit sharing, while I'm nothing against it, of course, I don't think it's any kind of a solution to the problem of perceived threat. And there is a great deal of evidence that it is, by the way that people have studied to put it, even if the owners, the workers own the whole plant entirely, they still get in disputes with management. They hire management, but there still has to be management, and they're going to fight with management.
I'm looking at Paul, maybe there's some sort of an overlay between what Paul is saying about the job being a threat. If you're threatened by the people below you and you're threatened by the people above you, it's certainly been...
And alongside it.
You know, co-workers, who's going to move up, who's going to move ahead of you. But I'm trying to place it in the relationship to, I believe, with Walt Bowman. Investors a few nights ago on vulnerability, that sometimes the threatening aspect of the job can be possible, you know, talking out loud or thinking out loud, can be removed if in some way you allow yourself to be vulnerable to those people around. You allow yourself to be vulnerable to the people below and the people above. And it's, I don't like to use the word open, it's not as hard a word as vulnerability. But that being vulnerability opens up particular areas and lines and communication back and forth to allow some of the things to work out. Of course, you can't make it everywhere. The foreman working with 10 guys, or over 10 people, always are usually threatened and is seldom vulnerable to them. He does not allow himself to be vulnerable. Does not allow himself to be vulnerable to the shift foreman over the section foreman. And so every action is pretty well taken and justified, you know, what he did. And when the guy can be vulnerable, saying, "Oh, can't get that screwed up," and whatever, it works. I guess I can't get any further to figure out how what we're going to talk about today helps me when I leave you. But I'd like to put those two together.
I like that you said vulnerability is a good way to. How do we learn to become vulnerable at work? How willing are we to be vulnerable at work? What happens when we do allow ourselves to be vulnerable? Is it possible that other people can learn the same thing, supposing that we have learned the lesson?
You see them by doing it. I kind of have a mental picture that sometimes I go through, and it's kind of reminded me that when someone's coming at you, you know, a threat, you can handle it either two ways. You can do yourself like kind of a tennis racket. Your heart, you know, if you're all strong and tight, you know, your hips. It comes bouncing back, right? But if it absorbs, you can absorb the energy, you can take all momentum out of it, and all the things can live by the law. Now, it works for me, it might not work for anybody.
That's
a
metaphor.
This is what I learned that time yesterday, though, and I think it was yesterday's Bible study. The whole idea that this is where Christ himself. What makes him so great is that he was vulnerable to people, much more in touch with the earth than what you and I are. And this is what he said, really, to become a real Christian, we have to be open and vulnerable. No matter where we're at, whether we're stepped on, kicked around, or anything.
I'm not Tim's kind of
well. Tim Booth had a, over here then.
To come down to practice use of some of the things I made suggestions on, we have six departments in the figure it out. And thinking, of course, the work was very time to time, sometimes we sort of many experiences, accepting the experience and seasons of us. So I suggested we train these people, all these six people in the police department, and we're looking to the two police departments working around to the situation. Because I have time to manage a while because we thought this was just up to all the departments. If I find out that would take care of some of the equipment and have the lights and how much the thing that they had already tested. Well, let's do it anyway. Let's do it. Let's do it. I'm the last person on the list, so you seem to be always in front of the country. And I was very much astonished to the result. Not the fact that they always think that we're getting more and they do that, they probably could do it. But they're all free because now I know what the other people are doing. I can do a better job myself. And that is one of the big faults I think in with a lot of people on the job and you just say all the time, you have a good chance to meet. They don't know what the other person is doing. And something comes out that the department's wrong, and they're always criticizing the stuff. But if they work in there, you spend at least as long as it happens, you wouldn't probably look at them. I think that's pretty much better working for it. Understanding what other people are doing.
I was impressed by what Paul was saying in terms of the market system and the hierarchical system. In that it seems to me in both systems, the people are leading from their strengths rather than their weaknesses, and it's only when we reveal our weaknesses to somebody that they're willing to trust us. And you yourself are revealing weaknesses as you talk, so that we have a sense of trust there. I think this is really the clue to Christianity, is that if you want to reach somebody, you let them know that you're a sinner too, and if you come out holier now, you can never reach them. And this is what Christianity was talking about.
It is working, and so now you could show your Christianity, and maybe you could do witnessing, personal witnessing, but what are the chances you behave in this way at San Fernando, the San Fernando?
Excuse me.
Or are we?
Without Paul, the California State University of Northridge, same place.
Okay. What are the chances that it would make faculty senate behave in a more humane fashion?
I suspect that those who like power would walk all over such churches.
And don't you have an obligation sometimes, or at least when you were chairman of the faculty senate, you had an obligation to defend the weak?
But when you reveal your weaknesses, the success indicators do not permit weaknesses to be revealed. And you have to make a decision. Are you going to be vulnerable, reveal that, and possibly be demoted or even lose a certain status or position? Or are you going to take the risk? You almost have to change the success indicators in order to reveal weaknesses, or you've got to prioritize yourself and say, you know, whether I do or not, whether I lose my job, lose the status, or respect in the eyes of the employer or employee.
You either have to stand into this world or the spiritual world.
Do we live in two worlds? Well, Lutherans have a doctrine that I've grown increasingly uncomfortable with, doctrine of the left hand and the right hand. That, there's a Christian who does not kill. He loves his brother. He even to hate his brother makes him a murderer. And he joins the army and he's killed. I say, well, but this is done in the kingdom of the left hand, as long as it's a just war, keeping order. He said, you know, that argument there's sense in it, of course, you know, just the fact that the Christian church is pacifism within the Christian church has been a continuing movement, never a dominant one, is testimony to the reality here that the schizophrenia that is inescapable, unavoidable. I become increasingly uncomfortable with that view. I increasingly feel that I cannot hold that and pray, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And I find myself drifting, moving rapidly toward the pacifist, which is unrealistic.
Was there any place in the Bible where there was a criticism of a soldier, of being a soldier?
No. But I believe you think. No. But you see, there are lots of things to which we are willing to criticize ourselves and our society which aren't criticized in the Bible. There's no criticism in the Bible of slavery either. It's even explicitly accepted. Well, implicitly accepted when Paul sends the slave back. on that one.
Even in terms of obedience to the state, many people, when you talk about civil disobedience and things, will go to Romans 12 right away, where God has instituted the state and you have to be obedient to the authorities. But then you take a look at the book of Revelation, and the state is conceived as a monster, you know, something which Christians are up against. And they are in that particular time period. And so even in terms of obedience to the state, you have sort of two words being given in terms of the Christian's response.
But then you have to go and the cost is still on the phone.
It's also talking about what's going on right at that time. We're back to Johansson.
Yeah,
it's
all right.
I think it's not out of the soul of the world, but back to the behavioral pattern, particular setting. My setting is an academic setting, and I find it very, very difficult to mingle the professional growth factor with the Christian factor in a secular world of bosses and colleagues. It becomes increasingly more difficult for me to work in this setting in a trust factor, because I simply do not trust the administrator, and I do not trust my colleagues about doing people I trust them to in terms of the setting. And the vulnerability factor, I think, is I can make myself vulnerable to my administrators, but it doesn't help in the professional scene at all. It helps in their personal life and in my personal life, maybe. But I just think maybe it's the success indicators that I haven't really dealt with. But in a realistic sense, I just find it practically impossible and sort of easier to believe it.
It's put the world.
Yeah. Well, to put myself from that world and go into a different kind of world, because somehow or other, I can relate to obnoxious souls in a teaching environment and tell them so, but I can't see an administrator who doesn't have any values that are at all similar to mine. His values are so far from my values that we don't even have any common ground to discuss it on, something where we can discuss it or finish it up, we don't think so.
Oh, maybe, Joanne, I would add, now maybe in your case you may know enough about the administrator, but sometimes the administrator is agonizing over the same problem.
I know.
All right, but in that case, it sometimes will occur that there are two people agonizing over the same problem and wishing, each wishing that the other, and no way of finding this out.
If our values do not come up in common, I don't see how you can dissolve it and let you live.
You know, I think there's a facet to the business world that I know that I'm striving for in the business that where I'm operating, and that is that many times you don't have to work with these things that we identify as Christian values in those terms at all. Many times you can identify those as if in fact you operate with some of these values and what we're dealing with the word trust here, you can come out of the thing with increased production, you can come out of the thing with happy employees, you can come out of the thing with things that are good for business, entirely unrelated to motives dealing with higher values. And I found in a number of cases that is a good selling point for some of the things that I particularly would like to see done, whether the reason that I want to see them done is my Christian background or not, this will work. And the fact that I can take a group of people and by applying some of the my own ideas and some of this thing that inherently becomes trust of them, and they reflect that thing, their trust in me, and then in their increased work and various other things that are good for the business, you don't have to relate the thing to your boss or your subordinate and say, you got to be a Christian. That doesn't mean anything in a lot of cases. But if you can say that this whole organization is going to run better if this happens and this happens, and then it in fact does, a lot of times that works.
Heart, you the certainly does work, and if you can establish, if you're blessed with some relatively high level of trust among good people, it's amazing how much more efficiently they can do it. My big standard example I use here is fishing. The big thing is people have a high level of trust. They went on and they get up and they're all out in the kitchen quite just before the meal is done and they wop their dishes out. And I challenge anybody to see a group of people paid money doing business more efficiently. But then there are other things. People don't know one another and they forget and they don't know and don't come in. And maybe they look around and say, oh, look at all the popping pans and go up and sit and dry today. But I'm also worried about, I wonder if trying to, use this fact that you try to create trust. The whole industrial sociology movement, going back to Elton Mayo and Roethlisberger and Dixon, was based on some of the insights. You can get people to feel a part of things, get them to understand when they step communications between the key words. And I had some successes, but I think it is fizzled out. And it is fizzled out basically because it's manipulative. And finally, if you are doing it for the sake of the profit, that is distrustful. And that is discovered.